Hey, everybody. Welcome to Tall But True, yet another fantastic episode. I'm Ben Bailey, your host, here with my good friend, Mr. DC Benny.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
What's happening, man? How you feeling?
Oh, I'm good. I'm schmitzing. It was hot outside.
It was a little hot. It's 97 degrees out there today.
Yeah.
And we are on location with our guest, the legendary David Steinberg.
Yay. Yeah. Hi,
How
Ben.
How you doing, David?
Good. Hi, DC. How are you?
Hey.
Good.
You guys have just met.
Yes.
Okay. Fast friends, I would say.
Well, fantastic to you know, to be here and be in your presence.
Oh,
man.
Thank you.
You know,
thanks.
Yeah, it's got to be interesting to meet someone for the first time in your living room.
It's very unusual, actually.
Great to meet you in my house.
Yeah, we hardly come into the living room. We sort of live like Anne Frank.
Stay in the attic most of the time.
Yeah. We come from the bedroom in here occasionally, and
setting it off.
Yeah, down here shushing people all day. There's people in the attic. So David and I are working on Cash Cab.
Yes. Yes. It's so much fun.
And we're having a great time. And it just sitting in the RV talking, I was like, man, you're obviously, and it's not like I didn't know this previously, a great storyteller. And I was like, we got to get him on Tall But True.
Yeah.
And the tagline is I was like, here's how it went. I was like, would you be interested? He was like, yep, sure.
Great. Why not?
Yeah. Some people make more of it, as you know,
yes.
I'm sure, of late, doing a show as a guest. But it's been really fun. You told me that story about Flip Wilson.
Oh, yes.
We were talking about, I was saying, you know, when I was a kid, I would sit up. My parents would be in bed. My sister would be in bed. Everyone's asleep in the whole house except me. I was 10 years old, and I was up with a blanket over my head and over the TV watching The Tonight Show and seeing David on there.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And then that shifted to the Flip Wilson show, and you told me this great story about Flip Wilson.
Yeah, he was a friend of mine. I did his show 6-8 times.
Right.
He was a very underrated comedian. He was he killed an audience.
Right.
He was as good as could be.
Right.
And, you know, I just knew him from the show. And
right.
we would hang out after the show and have a drink or whatever and, you know, just have some fun comedians together and sharing good audiences and bad.
Was he ever dressed as Geraldine while you guys were hanging out at the bar?
After a few drinks?
No,
that
was
his character, right?
I would have gone right home if I would have seen him as Geraldine.
Listen, Geraldine, I can't do this.
Yeah,
I have a wife.
He dressed as Geraldine, played that incredible character.
Mm.
He slept with more women than any man I know.
That's the key.
I thought, you
wear
know,
a dress, they never see it coming.
Them off.
I marked it down. You know, when things are bad, wear a dress. You never know. But so we knew each other, and I ran into him at a coffee shop we were at, and I had done the show the week before. And he said, hey, David, let's go have dinner tonight. I said, I can't. I've got a thing for, I think it was the B'nai B'rith, some Israeli temple thing in St. Louis.
Oh, right.
So he said, well, don't forget it. You don't need that. I said, no, they're paying me a lot of money, and they've all sold out and all of that. And I'm going to go. He said, I'll go with you. So I realized he, you know, he made a lot of money already at the Flip. Well, I said, Flip, you don't have to. So, well, you're going by yourself, right? I said, yeah. He said, I'll keep you company.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's great.
It takes you back when someone's that friendly and, you know.
Oh, he was amazing.
Should I be suspicious of this? But no, he's just a genuine
good guy. I never went there. I never went there at all because I knew him and I knew his social life. I knew everything about him. So I went to St. Louis. And it was for this Israeli thing, big sold out, a lot of Jews there. And as there are a lot of Jews here, too. So I did the show, was going pretty good, and Flip was backstage and all that, and he was laughing and carrying on, giving me the thumbs up and all, and I just couldn't resist. I said, you know, a friend of mine is here, and I don't know if he's willing to walk on stage or in the middle of my saying that, he walked on stage.
Oh, he just walked right out. Oh, that's awesome.
They went crazy. He was the biggest star in the country at the time.
Wow. That's
and amazing. He said, I'm only here because I like this guy. He was so flattering to me and all that. And he started to tell his stories. I told mine, went back and forth. Then this audience was on its feet at the end of it, of which never could have happened with just one lone Jew alone.
That's the name of the book.
One Lone Jew.
It's a sad book.
Yeah, wow.
Imagine that, DC. Imagine you're on stage somewhere a benefit or something like that.
Yeah.
And you have, like, I don't know who the equivalent would be.
That's what I was thinking.
But you just had some huge star.
Yeah, by the way.
Yeah, by the way, I have Louis C.K.'s here with me.
Exactly.
Should I bring him out?
Yeah. Coleslaw starts flying. Yeah. Pickles.
Yes, yeah. Louis. I couldn't think of anybody else. Yeah. We should have at least made him a black man.
Yeah.
I have Chris Rock.
Yeah.
That would just as good. Yeah. Just as good.
That would just be such a... I can almost not even imagine what that would have been like, too.
Well, you know, to be a stand-up comedian in the 70s was very different than it is now. First of all, everyone wants to be a stand-up comedian.
I know. There's so many. Yes.
You know?
Just in the time that we've been doing it. I mean, when I started, there was probably maybe a couple hundred comics.
Yeah.
In the country, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not even that many that were working.
Yes.
You know, there's a fair number that were like trying it or whatever. Now there's got to be 10,000.
In Astoria alone.
In Astoria. Yeah. Yeah. There's that many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I was in Houston and after my shows, I went into the bar at the club and there was like 60 people in there.
Yeah.
2 a.m. I'm like, is this bar still open? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, who are all these people that are drinking in the bar? They said, oh, these are all the comedians from the local scene.
Yeah, it's...
Like, there's 75 comedians in Houston?
Oh, it
what's happening?
Yeah,
it used to be something special.
It has to be unique. Yeah. And this glut of comedy. I can't walk down a street in Beverly Hill with some older Jewish guy coming up to me and saying, you know, I was riffing with my son today.
Oh,
and what? For the bar mitzvah, you were riffing?
Can you make them cool?
Yeah, they want to made him cool, and he's talking to another comedian the way we should be talking.
Yeah.
But you would think that being a comedian from my early career was always being an outsider, not an insider.
Right.
Because that's interesting.
Yeah, it's much less of an outsider thing now.
People weren't accepting of comedy as a career or as anything like that, and you had to have your own way of doing it, and it had to be very unique. And there were clubs, so most of the comedians who were friends of mine, like Richie Pryor at the time, and just all the guys that we were all good friends.
Right, that's really cool to hear.
Yeah,
because that's how it was for us.
Yeah,
we like the Comedy Cellar was sort of the home spot for a lot of us, and we just kind of became a family.
Yeah, that's what happened.
We all had our own issues with our actual families, and sort of ended up as comedians due in some part to that.
Yeah,
and then they sort of became our second family. And another very dysfunctional family.
That's just what I needed.
But brothers, in a way, you know.
Yeah, well, I never opened all the clubs that we worked in. Were not for comedians. They were either for jazz musicians or for folk singers at the time in the 60s.
Now that's here in New York.
Yeah, that's here in New York, yeah.
And you guys were performing at, do you remember some of the places?
Sure. Well, I performed at the Bitter End. That was one of my favorite places. I opened for Jerry Jeff Walker, a terrific country western guy. One of the best. He wrote Mr. Bojangles. That's his song.
No,
that's just one of them. But
such
so
a moving
I
op- song. Yeah. It's so sad,
oh,
that song.
Oh, it's a beautiful song.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So, we were opening for folk singers, and across the street at the Cafe Agogo, literally across the street, were Blood, Sweat, and Tears. In fact, Bobby Columbi, who was in Blood, Sweat, and Tears, we just had dinner.
Really?
A reunion dinner. We hadn't seen each other years.
Just recently.
Yeah, we're talking about 40 years ago, we just got together, and he wants to do a documentary about that time because it was all just musicians.
Would they call you guys monologists still at that point, or that was over? You were comedians by then?
You were opening usually for the music act.
Right.
So they didn't really...
I know comics were called, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, stand-up comics called themselves monologists. But that's back 50s and 60s, right? Is that
and it switched over and became
comedian.
Yeah, a monologist, like Will Rogers was a monologist. Yeah.
Right.
But a comedian, you're just getting laughs is what your job is for 45 minutes. Mm. And monologist is like an academic term
Yeah. Sounds like that.
It's not like, you know, it's like, you know, jazz musicians. I mean, Miles Davis, who I also opened for, and who, who we spoke for hours after each show that we had done, and I never understood a word he said.
Oh, that's fantastic.
He talked,
but it sounded
just
good,
nodding
though,
and smiling.
Nodding, he talked so quietly. And then he would go on stage. He was such a genius. So he had such a following. He he did a benefit at the Lincoln Center, and he asked me to MC it. So I was living in LA at the time. I came to do that. Right. And Miles went on stage, sold out because he was
Lincoln
so popular.
Center,
And he had a way of, all he cared about was the music. He was a genius, a jazz musician genius. Classical musicians would come to hear him.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember,
I've listened to lots of it.
And it's incredible. Amazing. And very atonal. Anyway, he would go on stage, thousands of people there to see him. And he would turn his back on the audience because he wanted to hear the music that he had created with the band. We're talking about a band of like six people. And him,
right?
So
he would turn away, and
his back,
purist.
His back was turned to the audience, and the music was incredible. It was so atonal; it wasn't melodious. He was so ahead of everything. Abstract kind of music, you know. It was a charity event, and I had to walk on stage and thank him. And he played the most obscure atonal music I'd ever heard, and I said, thank you, Miles, I'll be humming that for weeks.
And how did he react to that?
And he took me off stage in a headlock.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Miles Davis had you in a headlock.
You threw the headlock on. That's great.
Yeah.
I'll be humming that for weeks. He was like, you can't hum what I just did.
No.
Oh, that's amazing. No.
Yeah.
That is
great. So that was the atmosphere that I loved to be in with these musicians, all these artists, Bill Evans, and I wasn't even a jazz guy. And then the country western guys were all, that was, I happened to love those, that storytelling style of theirs. And so you were always in a creative community. There was, what could be better than that?
There's a resurgence of comedians performing in music venues for sure. And then when we started our show, when we started this live show in the
Tall But True Live
in the Zinc Bar
the old one, Urban Myth.
We would have jazz afterwards. We would we would tell the stories, and then people would hang out afterwards. And
sure.
It was a nice mix, you know, the comedy and the jazz.
It's about listening. Once you get an audience listening, it's the most exciting thing. It's just great.
Yeah. And that was such a cool little spot there.
Yeah.
Because we would stay, we would tell our stories and have a, it was always a fun show. It was everybody's favorite thing to do.
They had great mojitos.
Yeah.
They had great drinks. And then the jazz was amazing. So we would stay and listen to the jazz afterwards and talk about the show.
Yeah.
And laugh about who was unable to just tell a story. So funny. You could see him doing it. You could see like, oh, he's not getting laughs. He's going to stay. He's like, he's going into a bit.
Talking about toast.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as a comedian, you can't plan your career. You don't know what it's going to be. You know, don't know what
so
you're going to. So I was always in the Village. The Bitter End was my place to be. 120 people was a lot for the Bitter End.
Well, that's 3rd Street, right? I think it's still there. The Bitter End, same place.
Yeah, it's the same place.
Across from where we do the Tall But True storytelling now.
The Village Gate was just down the street, but they were music places and then stand-up comedians. Like, as I say, David Fry was around, Richie Pryor, a lot of the guys starting out.
Right.
And so, you know, so one night I come there and, you know, I would draw an audience, 50, 70 people, whoever wanted to come in.
Right.
And the guy who ran it was a guy named Paul Colby. And he says, David, there's six people in the audience tonight.
Right.
So I said, well, Paul, so let's just call it an evening, and you know, we'll do it another night.
Right.
He said, and he very smart. He said, you know, Dave, it's your job. You know. I said, you know, I could probably find in change six people's tickets and the money they spend. And he said, no. I said, okay, well, you know, I'll go on stage. And I went on stage. And I had talked about my early years at the yeshiva a lot satirically, actually, about being at a theological, Hebrew theological school.
Right, right.
And I talked about it a lot. So ironically, of the six guys, there were three guys there with yarmulkes, with little, you know, skull caps, sitting there. Yeah. So I thought, at least I got half the room before I walk out there. So
these are my people.
So, when you're a comedian, you go on stage and it's not that big, you can, pardon the expression, riff, my least favorite word.
Yeah.
But you can find a rhythm and just do it with them. But because
they can be great.
Yeah.
Sometimes, but because if they were good there, people, they could be great.
It became an education for me. They deserve the best show you could give them, no matter what.
No matter how many of them there are.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and at another time, I didn't. So I did as good a show as I can. I talked to the guys in front. And about a year ago, one of those guys, this I'm talking about like 40 years ago, 35 years, one of those guys had been one of those three guys and remembered it and reminded me of the night I was there.
That is so cool.
So yeah. I did this great show, as good a show as I could do, Ben. And then that was it. And, you know, I went to sleep and I thought, well, hopefully I'll have, you know, more than six guys tomorrow night.
Next time, yeah.
And Carly Simon and her sister Lucy lived above us, and I was an apartment below them on the east side. And Carly called, and my nickname is Doody, and she said, right. Doodle, have you seen the New York Times today? I said, Carly, it's like 7 o'clock. I did a show last night for six people. She said, go look at the fucking New York Times. And I looked at the New York Times in the entertainment section, and it said, David Steinberg, a cross between Woody Allen and Lenny Bruce, one of those six people was Dan Sullivan, who was from the New York Times.
Oh, my God.
And if that isn't...
And he stuck around, too.
He that's stuck around. Amazing. Oh, amazing.
Right. Wow.
And it literally, it's I'm telling you, point. It changed my whole career.
Yeah,
I became really. The next night you couldn't get into the area of the Village. That many people were there.
Oh my God.
And so
that was so cool.
Yeah.
Makes me feel better. Years ago I did a one man show and there were two people in the audience.
You're always gonna have
one
that.
Of them.
Yeah.
Could have been.
Yeah. One of them could have been. Yeah. We've all had those six people.
We've all had those. And you definitely wanna go, you know what, fuck this. I'm not gonna do this.
Yes.
You wanna pull the Red Fox from that classic story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where the band is told to play him on and play him off.
Yeah,
you know that one.
No, tell it to me.
Oh, it's so great.
Okay, tell me.
So they're supposed to play the Sanford and Son theme.
And Sanford and Son has been, it's now kind of off the air, and he's been like,
yeah, this is like toward the end of his career.
The crowds aren't coming out.
Like they used to, and the band is told to play the Sanford and Son theme, one of the best theme songs of all time. Yeah. I think Quincy Jones wrote it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. When he comes out, and then they play it again when he leaves, and. So he comes walking out, and they say, Red Fox, and he comes, and he goes, 15 motherfucking people. I ain't doing a show for no 15 motherfuckers. And he turns and he walks off, and the band plays the music again.
So
10 seconds later, they play him on, then they play him right off.
A walk-off music. Yeah.
Yeah,
I knew Red. Red was the most fun person.
Oh, awesome.
The most fun person.
Oh, he was so funny.
He was
such a genuinely funny man.
Yeah, I mean, when he was doing stand-up comedy, there were no African-American stand-up comedians. None at all. They hadn't even started then. And there were very few women comedians
that
started in the 50s. But his early albums are...
Those party albums.
Party albums. You start to see incredible stand-up comedian. He was a huge influence on Richie Pryor. Huge. Mm-hmm. And all of us, you know.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. You know, me, a Jewish kid listening to him, I couldn't get over him.
Right. He was just that fun. Naturally funny.
Yeah.
That was when I was growing up. My parents were very anti-television, so we would not, we couldn't really watch. We didn't really watch TV growing up very much. They had to select certain programs we were allowed to watch. But for whatever reason, Sanford and Son was one of those programs because
they let you watch it.
Yeah, we
just
because
it was that funny.
Yeah. It was so funny. Like, yeah. They would sit there howling, and it was, you know, it was like Masterpiece Theater and all this kind of educational stuff, but then there was Sanford and Son. So for me, it always, you know, it resonates.
It was great.
Oh, it's just such a classic show.
On Esther and...
Esther. That was great. Their rivalry, he and Esther back and forth.
Yeah.
Somehow, I remember one episode, they have an elephant. I don't know why. There's an elephant in the backyard.
Yeah, there is an elephant. Yeah.
And he doesn't know it. And he comes home and he opens the door and the elephant's standing there and he just goes, Esther. And he shuts the door again. So classic.
That's funny. You know who Bob Einstein is, right? Bob Einstein is...
I know the name.
Yeah. Bob Einstein is a comedy writer who wrote... for Red Fox.
Oh, okay. And, I've definitely heard his name, but I don't know.
And he's
about
incidentally one of the comedy standouts in Curb Your Enthusiasm that's on this year. And he's been, and you would recognize him, tall.
Right. He's actually on the show, or he's writing?
He's on the show. And his brother is Albert Brooks.
Oh, wow.
Right. And whose real name is Albert Einstein, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And Bob,
so crazy.
And Bob's real name is Einstein, Bob Einstein.
Right.
And so it's Bob Einstein and Albert Brooks, and they had another Einstein, which was Cliff Einstein, who did commercials. So I work with all of them. I work with Albert, I work with Bob, and I work with Cliff, because I learned to direct by directing commercials.
Oh, okay.
And their father was a guy named, he played a character that you see occasionally in old black and white movies. His name was called Park Your Carcass. It's like just a Slavic anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And
Park Your Carcass.
And he was on stage at the Friars Club. This I only know by history, having been passed down. And he had an attack of some kind, heart attack, something like that. And he, with Albert there and Bob Einstein there, all of his sons, he had a heart attack and died on stage.
Literally. At the Friars Club.
At the Friars Club in Los Angeles.
Maybe he got his bill for the $10 ginger ale that they have there. Yeah.
They were always accused of something nefarious going on at that Friars Club.
He really died on stage.
Yeah, yeah. And imagine for those kids. I mean, they're friends of mine. And yeah, it's really incredible.
I think that's why I had heard of Bob Einstein, because someone had told me that Albert Brooks... last name was really Einstein.
Yeah.
His name was Albert Einstein.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big fan of Albert Brooks, man.
Yeah. Well, Albert Brooks is off the charts. Yeah. Incredible.
He was such a great gangster in that. Did you guys see that movie Drive?
Yes.
Oh, he's such a great bad guy.
Oh, really?
Man.
I didn't see that.
Oh, man. You've got to see
it. He's a good bad guy.
Yeah. He is a good bad guy in that.
And a unique and wonderful stand-up comedian. Yeah. I mean, off the charts and incredible. And so Bob Einstein is on Curb, and he, you know, I direct him, but I have to stop him from talking every once in a while.
He gets started and
goes. Oh, that stopped. Doesn't stop.
Wow. Yeah, new Curb Your Enthusiasm's coming back.
Yes, this is one of our best seasons.
I'm super excited, man. It's such a great show.
It's great. If you liked it, then you'll love it.
That's, you know what's funny about Curb is, like, you know, you get a song in your head and it drives you crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get the music from Curb in my head.
Yes.
Yeah. And it doesn't bother me.
Oh,
I'm happy to be walking around humming the
Well,
Curb theme. You know, I don't know why.
Larry David is just one of the best comedy writers ever.
Mm.
He's in, you know, if you go back to Neil Simon and all these guys, he's in that category of the best comedy writer.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
you see it in this year, and he's a good collaborator, and he brings someone in with them. He collaborates, you know, and also he's just a terrific guy. He's like a good, he's not at all that asshole character that he plays.
Right.
He's the opposite. He's a very cynical, generous
guy. Well, he does it very well.
Right.
But you know what's great about it is you're like, I can't believe he's doing this.
Yeah.
He's such an asshole right now.
Yes.
But you're still on his side.
We can vent through him a little bit. There's some things where it's like, I wanted to do that, but there's just no way I could do. And then he does it, and you can kind of live vicariously
it's really incredible. And that outrageous part of him, it's not outrageous to him.
Yeah.
And as a person, he's, you know, everyone who knows him loves him. You know, he's just wonderful. But it's just about the writing. it's never enough. We could stay a few hours later. Let's stay a little few hours later. Almost all the well-written sort of sitcoms I got involved with, like Mad About You, the writers great stayed show. Late. Yeah. Seinfeld, Larry David, and Jerry. I was directing, so I would leave early, like around 11 o'clock at night from the lot, Radford Lot in
that was
Los
early,
Angeles.
Huh? CBS Radford.
Yeah. So I'd leave it at 11 at night. There'd be no other cars on the lot except for two cars, and it was Jerry's and Larry David's.
Wow.
So staying all the other writers had writing gone to make home, it and work. They were not, we could always do this better and better and better, and that's the level of sort of discipline that these guys have. Jerry's still phenomenal stand-up comedian, yep. writing new material all the time.
Yep.
Just, it's incredible.
Yeah, real craftsman. Yeah. He's definitely real.
No doubt about that.
Yeah. You know, I noticed.
That's amazing to think about that, though. That I think people who watch the shows don't necessarily understand what goes into them.
No.
And the dedication.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Like these guys, that's all they really were living for at those times was to make the shows as good as they could be.
Yeah.
And it seems like comes you're through. Just riffing.
Yeah.
Especially in that structure. It just seems so.
Yeah.
You know, just off the top of the head.
Yeah, but, well, speaking of that, Ben Bailey's sitting here.
Yeah.
driving a car.
Oh, I don't know how he did that.
And also riffing and comedy and has to hear what's going on all the time.
Car's
and,
overheating, right?
Yeah, we had the cash cab broke down yesterday.
Oh, my God. It's phenomenal to me to see him there. I'm in the back, and I see what's going on.
It's pretty incredible.
It's pretty incredible,
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's true.
It's a weird skill set. I delivered pizza and flowers and prescriptions. Like I drove for a living from the time I could drive. I was driving to make money. So, and then I was a limo driver toward the end. So that the driving, I always said that if you drive enough, you develop a sixth sense for driving.
Yes.
You know what people are going to do before they do it.
Yeah,
and it's definitely, I know it's true. I've seen, I've been out on the road with other guys who are drivers, and I go, he's got it. This guy's been driving a long time.
Yeah.
He knew that this idiot was going to cut in front of him before he did, so he slowed down.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the kind of thing. And I think if I didn't have that, you know, all those years of driving in my history, the show would be so much harder to do.
It like couldn't be done.
Yeah, I think maybe I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
You just have to have a double, or put it on a truck.
Yeah. No.
Put it on a flatbed and fake it, you know.
Because, you know.
When I'm old, that's what we'll do. I'm like, early cash cab.
But the thing about stand-up comedy is you have to listen. So you're not only driving, you're listening because you're a comedian. And you're driving the conversation as well. It's
like the
it's
guy
awesome.
Juggling the chainsaw, the watermelon, and the basketball.
Exactly.
You know, that's
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I think that might be a little harder and more dangerous.
Yeah.
It's like people are always like, stand-up comedy is the hardest job you could ever have. I'm like, brain surgeon is probably pretty tough. You can't just hang around the hospital and then take a shot at it when someone doesn't show up.
Well, you do have to have a thick skin because you only succeed by failing. If it comes too fast, you'll be done with.
Yeah.
But if it comes slow and you work it out and you, God, this worked last night, it doesn't work tonight, well, change it. And you keep on changing, and that's what makes it so elusive and fun when you get it right.
And there is a possibility of late blooming in this career a little bit.
Oh, yeah. You know, definitely.
It's youth-driven, but still there's a possibility.
Oh, sure.
You know,
it's never too late.
Good at it.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, and you see, guys, there's plenty of guys that we started with, and I'm sure this was the same when you were starting out. You see guys, and you're like, you know, I like this guy. He's a nice guy, but if I'm being honest, I don't think he's going to make it as a comedian. But then they stick it out, and then 10 years
what
go by, and all you know, like, and then I see them again. I go, he's gotten really good.
Yeah.
He's stuck with it. It evolved into something unique and very funny.
Yeah,
and I never would have seen it coming. So
no, it's how hard you work.
Yeah.
And some are in touch with the voice immediately, and some it takes a while before, you know, like even the old Jim Carrey story about how he started out just doing impressions, and then he just scrapped everything.
And started
and
again.
He's doing these original strange characters that, you know, typically you would not think people other than your friends may laugh at, but yeah, it's so tough bizarre. Sell.
Yes.
He did it and he stuck with it, and then what that's what yeah. people
I think he's going to make it at yeah. some point. I think things are going to come together for him. stick with it, Jim.
He had the benefit of being a Canadian.
Yeah, right.
right. Yeah, that's your secret, yes, Canadians. That's not fair. They're foreigners. Yeah. So they're yeah. unique.
Yeah. yeah.
Do you remember the first time you went on stage?
Oh, sure.
It's a silly question because I think everyone does, but
it was Second City, and they had already seen me do some little things around.
Oh, Second City is that Chicago?
Yeah, Second City. Yeah, all of the improvisational stuff, all of it comes from Second City.
Right,
Second City, Chicago. It was a small group started with Mike Nichols, Elaine May, Alan Arkin, man. Sort of well known to certainly older Alan generation, Arkin, but not known to the younger.
I would watch anything with Alan Arkin in it.
yeah, yeah,
just,
yeah,
I don't yeah, care.
It was
it's
incredible.
Just that.
He's yeah. so
funny. It's just great to watch. I love yeah. that guy.
And they so one of the things that they did, and I stayed at Second City almost for 6 years, and I must say very wow. modestly, I owned the place at one point. It was made for me. Oh. I the improvisation, because you had to have information.
Right.
And so the first night I was watching.
Is this where the sermons
came from there.
Sermons yes. came from there. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are amazing. Man.
Yes. Yeah. I would take a suggestion of any Old Testament personality. And I would do a sermon, and none of them knew that my father was a rabbi, so there's no sermon that you could stump me on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I started every sermon the same way. If they'd say Moses, I say, well, tonight's sermon deals with the personality of Moses, who had a wonderful rapport with God, whom I'm sure you all remember from last week's sermon.
Remember the one of the main characters from last week,
yeah,
God,
yeah.
is back in this week's sermon.
Yeah, that was one of them. But the first time I went on stage, this incredible company, they would do operas, and they and the audience would shout out the style of the opera, Puccini or something. I didn't know any opera at all,
right.
And I just was in awe walking them. And then we take a fairy tale, and they would have to integrate the story of the fairy tale into the opera.
Oh,
so
wow.
So you do the fairy tale, whatever it was, and then the opera. And I was just standing backstage thinking, I'm never going to get on stage. And then they were doing Rumpelstiltskin.
It's just gonna take
forever, yeah. They're doing Rumpelstiltskin. And they were about to go into this big aria of, you know, guess my name, yeah. guess my name. You know, you can imagine we're in a, and I didn't even, I don't even know, my feet propelled me on stage, and I walked across, and they were doing, is it George? Is it Moise? Is it, and I walked across, I said, hi, Rumpelstiltskin, haven't seen you since college.
You just walked right up there
cord,
and did it.
Curtain came down.
Oh,
no
wow.
one, no one spoke to me for a week.
Oh, they were pissed.
They were pissed. They were about to
kind of
take
blew
off.
The ending.
Right. Yeah. If I were backstage, I would have been pissed at me.
But you got a big laugh. I'm sure you got a huge.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
the first time you ever went on stage.
The first time, yeah,
wow.
for a comedy. Yeah. That started me.
That's it, though. That's
yeah. so cool.
That's it. You hear yeah. that laughter?
That's it.
And that's it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, these guys were all professionals, so they just hugged me and looked after me, and they were older than me, and it was great.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know your dad was a rabbi. We had a thing where we put all our stuff in storage in Brooklyn, and then everything got destroyed, so
yeah.
I had to call the warehouse. And the guy who owned it was a rabbi, and I was like, hey, man, you know, we signed all this stuff and blah, 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 blah. And everything's been destroyed, so how are we gonna get repaid for it or whatever? He's like, yeah, you're not gonna.
Yeah,
why not? He said, God works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
That's the Lord works in mysterious ways. Yeah. He destroyed all your stuff, and yes. now you're screwed.
Not that had anything to do, no. but it was just.
But there's
just,
a lesson. No.
Yeah,
there's a lesson somewhere.
All my earlier material in Canada was sort of geared that way. You know, I one of my lines was that they still, every Canadian asked me to say it for them, was, my dad never lived to see his dream of an all Yiddish speaking Canada. Because they're always fighting the French speaking all that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Yeah, it's all of that. So I found it, you find an audience by doing the most personal thing,
yeah.
not the most general thing.
That's interesting.
So,
it's true. I, you know, yeah. people would always say to me, my stand-up is sort of surreal, observational kind of stuff. Like, it's observational, yeah, but then it's a little, there's a little bit of crazy thrown in there.
Yeah, there's yes, a little Dolly-ish quality.
It's a little bit of melting clock yeah in there.
But owl.
Yeah, the owl, yeah. Yeah. I have like a 10-minute bit about an owl keeping me awake at night. And I kill him in the end. Yeah. But, sorry. Spoiler alert. But that was one of the biggest suggestions or criticisms that I would get from agents and people on the industry side was, this stuff isn't personal to you.
Oh.
You need to find your own voice. And if you're yeah speaking about your own life and things yeah that are real, it's going to resonate with the audience more. Mm-hmm. And I was always like, fuck you. I'm writing what I feel. I'm writing, this stuff is coming from my heart, you know. But I have to admit that, you know, just in the last 6 months or so, I started doing some bits about what it's like to be tall.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't think it's any brilliant writing or anything, you know, mm-hmm, but the crowds eat it up.
Well, they're looking at you and you're yeah tall. And it, so it's visually.
It's the reality. Visually, is coming
yeah, yeah. You have a built in prop.
Yeah. Yeah. That, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're connecting it's just like it's, to it's, what you're
I'm
saying.
I'm talking about my real life and, they, and yes, they can see that and something, somehow that makes it more, yeah, more real to them or whatever. But so if only I had listened. But no, it's another, you know, like we were saying before, yeah, you're still growing as a performer as long as you keep doing it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I feel like I'm just over the last 5 years sort of really getting my voice in doing what I'm doing, and it's not, it doesn't hit 100%, but when it hits, it really
where do you work out, where do you go to work out?
Well, you know, the Comedy Cellar and the
Comedy Cellar
in the Eastville,
yeah,
and
yeah,
the
yeah
usual,
there are
Manhattan,
so many of those clubs.
The Stand, yeah, there's a lot of clubs now. When we started, there was like, we started around the same time, yeah, like mid-90s, I guess, yeah, or maybe early 90s. Right. There's only a few clubs, and then there was less for a little while. And now, yes, I mean, there's comedy everywhere, it seems.
Yes. Well,
and some of the best places to perform are not the clubs. They're these
yeah
rooms
yeah
that music venues and these random, you know, the Knitting Factory on Sunday or this,
yeah,
the Bell House or these random places that yeah you wouldn't even think in, but they've really cultivated a sort of comedy connoisseur crowd that comes out.
That's nice.
And the pressure's off a little yeah bit. You know, the right pressure's off a little
it's
bit.
It's a little more clubs laid back. Yeah. You I know mean, to work out at the Cellar all the time, you feel like you have to kill in there.
Yeah.
Or so, you know, even, it doesn't matter how, you know, high up you get in the business or how successful you are, you still yeah have that, you know, oh, like it's got to be a good show or yeah people are going to,
well, the bar's set high,
gonna lose my yeah slots. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, Louis said something great about that. He went and taped a special. Louis C.K. taped a special at the Comedy Store in mm-hmm L.A., which yeah is where I started.
Oh.
And also where he started.
How?
And he said something that resonated so much with me, especially because it's the same club. He said, no matter how successful I get, because this is where I started, this is where I did my first show ever,
yeah,
I still get nervous when I go in. When you know, he's that's saying when he goes yeah into the store, he still gets nervous.
Yeah, yeah,
he's taping a special. He announced it like 2 days before it sold the place out
yeah
in a half an hour. Yeah. But he's nervous about yeah you know how it's maybe going to go.
Yeah, but he's,
but that's the nature of it.
Yeah, and he's truly in just a handful of the best comedians I've ever been on stage
oh,
in
yeah
stand-up. Where Robin and I used to go see him in a little club.
Oh yeah,
in L.A. when he didn't have more than what 20 people there yeah and 30 people, and he was phenomenal then.
Yeah,
and
yeah
risking everything, and wouldn't repeat. He'd come back. Okay, I've got that down. I don't
yeah
need. And
yeah, he's
prolific
always,
guy.
He does, yeah, prolific writer, yeah, and he and definitely strong, works very
yeah
hard.
Yeah,
at
work.
It.
Yeah.
And then there's Pootie Tang. So
yes. Extremes.
Yeah, the extremes for
yeah
sure.
Yeah.
No offense, Pootie Tang.
Right.
You're still
you
a legend.
Love you.
I love Louis' bit about when you feel like God has run out of extras
yes
in a movie of your life.
Yes.
When you're walking around, you just see the same person that you don't know again.
Yeah.
That's like,
wow,
very
God's
funny.
Using that pair of that yeah woman again.
Yeah. Yeah. He's remarkable.
Yeah. So here we are up here. Do you still ever do you miss stand-up at all or
yeah oh sure
it's, I was gonna ask if you still do it at all.
I do
you
know? Yeah yeah I
because it's like a mobster, you get out but they pull you back in, like the people yeah look at the ones that, you know.
Yeah, I did it about a year ago. I was doing it a lot but I had my show on Showtime, Inside Comedy. So
that kept
me busy and in it. But yeah, I went to the La Jolla Playhouse in San Diego and started to work out one. And at Bucks County, I did a couple nights there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Had it been a long time?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it took me, for those two nights that I just threw away, it took me 3 weeks to get it.
Right.
Any of those nights in shape.
Uh-huh. Wow, yeah.
Yeah. But it came back in some way.
Any time off, it's a curve when you're coming back.
Yeah.
I took 8 months off. Not intentionally, but when Cash Cab first kind of hit, I just was so busy that year, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so 8 months went by without me doing a stand-up show, and getting back, it was like walking out on a ledge again.
Sure. Yeah.
And it was like, oh my God, how am I this rusty after just that amount of time, you know?
Yeah.
That's a long time.
I vowed to never let that much time go by again, because I kind of need it.
Yeah.
It's almost like a...
Yeah, it's a muscle.
It's
you
therapy.
Can't, you, or, yeah. Yeah, it'll go away if you don't practice on it.
It does change if you're in a bad mood and you go up there and you have a great set. Suddenly, that's all gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Suddenly, it's like, what was
you're happy as
about?
Could be.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. It kind of heals me doing it. Like what I was saying the other night, whatever is going on, if it's physical pain, emotional pain, if I'm sick or whatever it is, you get a couple of jokes
there.
In, it just goes away. It's just gone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
even
the
if you
most
have to
fun.
Pee, that goes away.
Yeah, it does. It evaporates for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, then an hour later, you're like, oh my God, I still have not urinated.
Yeah.
But my recollection of everything is that it's the outsider part of stand-up comedy that I feel is missing from the new communities, because it's no longer an outsider's profession.
Right.
Everyone wants to be a comedian now.
Right, it's mainstream
it doesn't make you a bad comedian or a good comedian, but it's
the landscape.
It's the landscape has changed tremendously.
Yeah, you see child stand-ups now. Like just,
really?
I don't know if that was a thing when, you know, you were in your heyday, but like it's kids that are like... Yeah.
Little kids doing it.
Yeah.
No, what do you have
over.
To talk about?
That's it. It's over now.
And it's about information. It's about being smart, not, you know, not school smart, but smart. Something that, you know, you put together that connects to the audience. That's just one of the most exciting things.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. For me, it's meant to be an escape for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like if they can forget about the stuff that's worrying them, stressing them out just for a minute while they're listening to you.
Yeah.
When they thank you for that, when someone comes up and it's like, I just had this awful thing happen and I got to forget about this.
Yes.
That is just the best.
That is the best. Definitely. Yeah, that's the reward right there.
Yeah. You never know who you're touching.
And then somebody comes up right after and was like, you were awful. You were terrible. I'm so offended.
I can't believe you said that.
Yeah.
People get offended at some ridiculous things. I've had. Did you ever have a really terrible heckler or someone who?
Oh sure.
Yeah, you must have. Right?
Yeah. Well, remember that I was on Nixon's enemies list.
Oh,
so
right
they
now.
Every time that I went on stage, someone would heckle me at that time because I was on the Tonight Show doing the material through Carson, and so if it was an election year, his little group was watching me. And the way in which they would get even, it took me a long time to figure it out. I write with a friend of mine, Ziggy, and every once in a while you get heckled, but all of a sudden, every time I went into my political Nixon material, you dirty kike, you, I mean, it was really vile and scary.
And they were sent there to do that to
yes.
you?
Yes, yeah.
Wow. So you're on Nixon's enemies list.
Yes.
That's something.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a comedian, but I did have the Tonight
Show. Powerful.
Tonight Show. Right. That made the difference. Johnny listening to me and laughing and all that. So that was scary.
Yeah, I can't
imagine.
Random heckler, or even one person who's not laughing, and I'm like, my God. Yeah.
And then you get to recognize a voice in different places that we are all over the country.
Right, it's the same guy doing it.
And then it's Ziggy who writes with me saying, I'm telling you, David, it seems like the same guy. We couldn't even put that together at the time.
That's so
strange.
Because
remember, stand-up comedy was not a well-accepted profession.
Right.
And people didn't really get excited about stand-up comedians. They would say, oh, this guy's really funny, or that guy's really funny.
It'd be a cool documentary to track that guy down.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Where is he now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's actually started, he's trying to be a comedian. Right?
Right. Yeah. At this point. Exactly.
We can find him and ruin it for him.
Open his open mic.
I'll take a
I remember you.
I'll take a suggestion of any Old Testament personality. Moses, okay. And do my material.
It's weird, though, that they would do that. Yeah, right, he's doing your act.
Yeah.
Like, to what end did they think that you you just give up? It's, oh, I can't take it. These guys have made this too difficult.
Well, the colleges in those days was very different than what they are now. They were incendiary and wanted to do the new thing, and also I was representing them. I was the same age as they were.
Right.
And they
just... Yeah, now they're afraid of everything. Colleges. Right. It's just like, you can't say anything.
Yeah.
I said the word Japanese.
Uh-oh.
And there was like a... I can't even specify someone's nationality.
No.
I didn't say anything about Japanese people. I simply said that a man was Japanese.
Yes. Yeah.
It just means he's from Japan. How could that possibly be offensive to anybody?
Some sushi got offended somewhere.
That's right.
The salmon didn't like it.
Yeah.
Wow, I can't imagine having people follow you around and...
Oh, it was incredible.
And try to tear you down like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was...
Especially from a high level of... You know, it's not like they're just guys off the street. They have
purpose. Yeah, a big audience coming there, and
crazy
Secret Service.
Yeah.
What was Carson like? I mean, I know you did the show a lot of times,
a lot.
I loved him. He's still my, no offense to the guys since, but he's still my favorite.
Oh, he
it's
was
kind of like your James Bond. Who was James Bond when you were the right age for that?
That's a great analogy.
Oh, he was a big. Jazz was his music, and comedy. He could do it. He was,
and he could watch too.
He could watch, and I was very different than anyone else.
Right.
Not to him, and he just had me come back over and over again, and he gave me a career. Literally, my career comes from the Tonight Show.
Wow.
So cool.
Yeah. And that guy in the six people.
Yes. Like
Johnny Carson with and the Sullivan, the writer for the New York Times.
Yes. Dan Sullivan. That's exactly right.
Did you ever hang out with Johnny?
Oh, sure.
Off the show? You must have. If you did it so many times.
I would go to...
I just was such a fan of his.
I was the kid.
Right.
I was the kid. If I go to an evening with their wives, with Don Rickles and his wife, and Johnny and one of his three wives, and and it was an incredible. They were all very, very funny.
Mm.
They were witty. They were funny. They teased each other unrelentingly.
Right.
Were the wives funny?
No. No.
You set that up, and David was like,
no.
No.
The wives,
no thought, no
the, question. The comedians, they would be killing in the room, and the wives were like sitting shiva. They were like, he's doing that story. I've heard that a thousand times.
Yeah. Why don't you tell that one again?
Oh, wow.
Carson, to me, was the guy who could do all of it.
He was amazing.
He was a great interviewer.
Yeah.
A great comedian. He could get funny out of
everybody.
Almost any situation and any guest. But he could sit and watch, and he could be
absolutely
watching and letting it happen too, which I think a lot of hosts are there.
Yeah, no, that's right, Ben.
They're a little bit loath to do that.
Never was in conflict with you. He was never in competition. He loved it when you were good. You know, and look at how many comedians came through him.
That's uncommon that you're not in competition, and you know that somebody really fosters that.
Yeah,
you know, in that position.
Yeah, because they seem competitive for who's the funniest person here, you know, which is, it's like, you know what, if this person is a guest on your show, it's still you, you know, it's part of the show. You should want it to be as good as it can be.
I think it's different if they take a shot at you and you gotta show them who's boss.
Yeah.
You know,
my wife just pointed to my watch.
Yes.
Mm. You didn't see that. But, you know, I always had a way of knowing when the audience had too much. It wasn't when they looked at their watch, when they would shake it to see if it had stopped.
It came right after the comment about the wives not being funny.
Yeah, exactly.
Robin was like, all right, wrap this up. Women are funny too, damn it.
wife's hilarious. If she's listening, she's hilarious.
Yeah. And my wife and I, we work together. So that's got to be some reward in heaven for that.
She shows
for
you the watch.
Robin, for and, sure. Yeah.
Time to wrap it up, David. Yeah. Wrap it up. Well, this was great, man. I really appreciate you doing it.
That's great,
Ben.
It
was so fun. And just to hear, get a taste of what it was like for you then, you know, similar to when we were starting, but obviously totally different in some ways, too. Yeah. And just to, you know.
I enjoyed it with both of you guys. It was just great.
Cool,
just
cool.
Great
thank
to,
you
great
very
to
much.
Meet you, yeah.
And my father's going to be super psyched. He's a huge fan of yours.
Oh, great.
wait till we get out of here. Good. That'll be, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to David Steinberg. Thanks so much, man. It was great. Thanks for listening to Tall But True. Guys, if you haven't subscribed yet, please do. You can always see what I'm up to by going to therealbenbailey.com. I'm Real Ben Bailey on social media across the board. Chime in, say hello. Let me know what you think of Tall But True and other things. DC Benny.
Real DC Benny and DCBenny.com. How about that?
Check those out and come back. More great episodes of Tall But True coming in the near future. Excellent.
Thanks. Good, guys. That was fun.